Hello, Mage fans. This is Mage the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm your host, Adam Simpson. I'm joined today by Terry Robinson. We're going to bring you another episode of Tomes of Magic. Today, we're going to be talking about Lost Paths. But before we start our main topic, I just wanted to open it up to a little bit of housekeeping. Terry and I were given the excellent news by our producer that our podcast is number 5 in the Mediterranean nation of Malta. That is awesome. That is an achievement that I've always aspired to, and I'd like to see another podcast top that in Malta, mind you.
Well, I mean, technically as number 5, 4 podcasts have surpassed us. So, but yes, thank you to both residents of that tiny micronation for listening to us.
So. Yes, thank you. And we're going to try to bring you the kind of content that will propel us to the lofty position of number 4 in Malta. We can do it. Another thing I wanted to mention was I really wanted to give a big thank you to our executive producers who help us to bring out these episodes. It was just recently that I was able to purchase some recording equipment that attaches to my microphone and improves recording quality and makes my life easier, and I just really appreciate that. So I wanted to say thank you. And Terry, do you have any announcements for us?
I do. One of my goals for 2021 was to read the Mage Core rulebook in Spanish. This was stupid for 2 reasons. 1, my Spanish isn't that good. 2, the Mage Core rulebook is very big. But one of the interesting things that came with that is I bought the Spanish Kickstarter set, for lack of a better term, and it comes with way more stuff than the English one did. Like, it includes a basic quest, it includes a bunch of bookmarks and a bunch of art prints and some dice and everything. And I'm like, oh man, if only we could do this kind of stuff in the US. And then I'm like, oh wait, we do with literally every other game that's not White Wolf. But one of the neat things about it is it includes a glossary with Spanish to English translations. And this is kind of funny because for me, most of these don't require a translation. Like words like paradoja for paradox, you look at it, you're like, okay, I think I figured out what that one is. But one of the neat things is it includes translation notes of why they went with certain options as opposed to others. Like, one of the ones they mention is the fact that, hey, we just use the word changeling directly for changeling because there isn't a Spanish language equivalent. Otherwise, we would have gone with something like Niño Cambio, the changing child. And another one that I was particularly fond of was that it includes a pot shot at French, where they talk about the garou, and they talk about how in Spanish they just went with the term hombre lobo, wolfman. But in French they do loup garou, which technically means man werewolf. And they're like, this seems stupid, but they're French. And I'm like, yes, just take a shot at the Gallic long empire. Yep.
Yeah, there's a long tradition in British culture of taking minor pot shots at the French, but it helps to understand that it's not actually mean-spirited. It's all in fun, and the French they certainly get their pot shots in too. Let's not leave that out.
Yeah. So I just
well, today we're looking at Lost Paths. This is a book for Revised Edition Mage. Came out in 2001. And it covers 2 crafts or disparate mage factions. One is the Alibatine and the other is the Taftani. These were both groups that were mentioned in earlier mage books. However, the Taftani were new to Revised Edition. And this is the book where we finally get a lot of good content helping us understand their background, what they're like, what they're after, and how they work their magic. And there's also a section, a chapter on the end for djinn. And these are basically umbrood spirits, spirits from the Umbra, but they are not quite like the umbrood that we have seen in past books. So it was a new family of supernatural creatures. And so this book is about 125 pages. It came out in 2001. It has one author, Craig Blackwelder. And so in the spirit of this book, as Terry and I were preparing for it, we decided to also pursue that mystic goal, the Alibatine, the Unity. It was actually going pretty well to start with, but then it was discovered, Terry drinks coffee in the morning, I drink tea. And after that, the Unity was just impossible. Just wasn't going to happen. But the show must go on. And in that spirit, we are going to turn to a walkthrough of chapter one about the Ali Bateen, and I think Terry is going to help us out here.
I think one of the most impressive parts is Craig Blackwelder is listed in the tradition book Akashic Brotherhood as having died in a hail of bullets and left at the watershed. Please send no flowers. We prefer to think he's just on the lam. Apparently that ended. That's good. And we got a book out the other end. The Ali Bateen section starts with a prelude called Things They'll Overlook, which involves a Nefandus wearing a mask of another person, quite literally from what they suggest, being held in place with spider silk, trying to seduce and kill a businessman in an airport until they find out that they have picked the wrong person, and then to celebrate the fact that they made a mistake, they stab themselves in the chest with a ceramic knife. Immediately after that, we get a glossary of terms. The formation of the Ali Bateen is somewhat unique among the groups in that it ties to a very specific historical metaphysical event. During the Himalaya Wars, there was a group of Akashiana and a group of Hondura, which was a sect of the Euthanatoi, who met one night during a... No, I have that. I have that mistaken, don't I? I do. I have reached the Darawushim no more than 2 hours. That's what it was. This event is known as the Night of Fauna, and during this event, the Warring Hands group within the Akashic Brotherhood, within the Akashiana, run into a group of dervishes, essentially, known as the Darwushim. They are spending quality time in each other's presence, a dance begins, and in this mystical moment of contact between these two cultures, something super weird happens, and because of the pattern of dance that they were doing and the interaction of the awakened avatars there, for a brief moment, there is a brief rousing of this ancient entity or future entity known as the Entelechy, which had been banished from the human realm aeons ago or had gone dormant aeons ago. The pieces of it survived, but no one remembered it. When they began this dance pattern, they activated something called the Quajat al-Akbar, and this entity tried to touch reality again. Reality was not able to receive it. It shattered, and the broken shards of this entity became the avatars of the Bateeni. This introduces the idea that you can accidentally magic, like that your character might sneeze in a particular way or do a particular hand signal in some area of the world, and magic that they didn't know exist could activate. This reinforces the idea in Revised that there's way more magic out there than what is just done by mages. And those become the first members of the Ali Bateen, having been exposed to the Doctrine of Unity. And the Doctrine of Unity is something that's been mentioned in Mage before, but in this book, we get the actual text of it. It gives you something that a Bateen character can quote from. It's something that you can scroll on in-game artifacts. The first big event to me was in around the year 100 CE. The first of many, Ishak al-Jinani, wants to learn the cliffpothic spheres, the Nefandic dark reflection of the spheres, and in the process falls to corruption. This leads to the institution of the Ketub as a institution who are masters of mind that kind of do two things. One, they check to make sure that everyone's on the level, and two, they kind of act as a mental network that holds together the Bateen. They use telepathy to communicate over long distances, to access the Web of Faith, which is something we'll talk about a little bit later, and they also create more or less a League of Assassins to take out the any dark agents that they find in their midst. One of the things that was mentioned in previous editions, which is somewhat brought back for this one, is the idea that for whatever reason, members of the sect who awaken in the sect are not able to access the sphere of entropy. In many cases, this leads to their own hubris, as they're like, ah, entropy is outside of our purview, thus it is not something we have to worry about. We are perfectly balanced. And they say that all the way to the calls. If we were to look at the sections in this book, each one contains a whole bunch of great ideas, and one where you're kind of like, eh? And in this one, to me, for the Ali Bateen, it's the idea that they may have invented Islam. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with this, although in the Order of Hermes book, they called Jesus a magician. So they claim that when Muhammad was contacted by Jibril, that was actually the work of the Qutubs. And over the next 20 years, they tried to sculpt the nascent culture of Islam, but that it was blended with beliefs that Muhammad already had, as well as a number of other cultural things, and it kind of got off basis, but by and large was still considered to be a vehicle for the Ali Bateen. In 1819, they discover a huge amount of quintessence in the Holy Land, and one of the interesting things about how this is presented is the idea that it is not necessarily the case that oil is quintessence, but depending on paradigm, your belief that there is value there can cause the oil to be a container for quintessence. They talk about later in the Web of Faith that it was actually a network of pipes that moved water around, and that was used as a medium for quintessence. And then later there was a network of letter delivery and courier service, and they would be used to deliver tasks, and that eventually it became mapped onto the oil that was found in the area. And I thought that was a neat idea, that you could map a potent quintessence store to an existing natural resource, and harvesting that natural resource would also harvest the quintessence. The Bateen attempted to defend it from interlopers, read the technocracy, and in the process of doing so, their connection to Mount Kaf was destroyed. Mount Kaf is a place of great significance to the Bateen. It used to be where they met up, and one of the places where some of the initial negotiations to form the Council of the Nine Mystic Traditions was formed. Eventually, the physical manifestation of it was lost. I don't know how you lose a mountain, but they're pretty straightforward that it was gone, and people are like, ah, it'll be in the Umbra still, and then they're like, oh, nope. Not in the Umbra anymore. That's weird. The Ali Bateen take a great blow as the technocracy gets more and more interested in the natural resources of the area. And sometime between 1819 and 1914, the Qutubs disband to prevent the NWO from finding them. At some point, the New World Order had figured out that they're using this psychic network to keep the group together, and they quickly take out a large number of them. In 1910, the first of the Bateen come to the United States. They join the exodus to Dearborn, Michigan, started by Henry Ford. Michigan is the state that has the highest percentage of its population that are Arab. In the 1920s, to protect their homeland, the Ali Bateen withdraw from the traditions and say, nope, this is something we have to do. We're going to do it alone. The next great change happens with the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, which is suggested as being a figure that was beyond the control of the technocracy, which allowed the Bateen to start acting again. And that in 1979, a bunch of Bateen stepped out of occultation, which is the process by which they kind of remove themselves from reality and begin being active again. And that is kind of presented as, in a number of other books, they say, ah, the Bateen are starting to become active again, and so on and so forth. And this ties that to a particular event, that a whole bunch of Qutubs who had stepped out of reality for whatever reason step back in and start doing stuff again. The next part goes into their beliefs, and it is centered around the idea of this doctrine of unity. One of the questions they quickly bring up is, the group invented Islam, and most of its adherents adhere to Islam. What is the point of adhering to a religion you came up with? And they consider questions of religion to be more riddles and objects of reflection rather than actual doctrines. And it is kind of interesting because they specifically say that they generally have a fondness for monotheism because a man cannot serve multiple masters. And later on, the Taftani are like, one God? Who would limit themselves to just one God? That's stupid. They mention that they try and stay healthy and often do this with manual labor and traveling on foot. I'm like, okay, that's one way to do it. We also get a mention to the barrier of ages, that a lot of these basic questions of the foundation of the group, many of their seers and scryers have tried to look back to see what actually happened, but something called the barrier of ages prevents them from doing so. Their notion of ascension is not quite explained, but the idea is that the chain of cause and effect represents the degree to which you are tied to the operations of the tapestry. And occultation, which is the process by which they raise their arcane rating to ridiculously high levels, is a process of slowly cutting those ties. And that when you fully cut those ties and are freed from the constraints of cause and effect and cease to exist, then something else happens. They consider the traditions to be weak-willed. The technocracy has attacked them on every front. They particularly hate the Nafandi, but mummies, they appear to be on our side, and we're really cool with that. And I'm like, okay, that's good. Organizationally, the Ali Bateen are divided into five great khanates who are what I will call schools. You are tested and you go through a sequence of them. The Ketubs are masters of mind who maintain the telepathic network between the individual members, probably less important in an age of cell phones and satellite phones, but who knows. The Murshids are the adepts that train and educate most of the members. They tend not to be too innovative because the Ketubs kind of exercise a iron hand over the group. And they mention that they are no longer a telepathic network so much as a pirate radio station that sends out broadcasts periodically. And I like this idea that your characters could be somewhere and just get a telepathic cry for help, or they have a recurring dream which is a call for aid or something like that. As far as finding new members, they look for avatars that were part of the Shards of Entelechy or could be attuned to it. Also, they kind of do some light brainwashing in the first year to get you through the rough parts, and the book is like, is this brainwashing? They're like, no, it's not brainwashing. All they do is change what you think and feel to be more in accord with what is convenient to them. And I'm like, that's called brainwashing. This adherence to mind magic, one of the forms of punishment they take is they kick someone out of the group and they erase all memory that they were ever part of it. I like the fact that both the Toftani and the Ali Bateen have interesting takes on justice. And the next thing we get then are the factions. And when I think factions, I think Adam Simpson. Adam, do you have any thoughts on what we said so far before we get into factions?
First off, when I started reading this, I was noticing how closely this adheres to material on the Ali Bateen from the Book of Shadows, which has the number 7 on the spine. It was roughly halfway through the first edition of Mage, and that was where the Ali Bateen were first introduced, and the five khanates, or, you know, sub-factions within the Ali Bateen are lifted right from there. The names are the same, and a lot of other material is adhered to closely. When he was describing the Night of Fauna, when the Ali Bateen formed, there was a lot of passages taken, like, almost word for word right out of Book of Shadows. So that was interesting to know. As Terry mentioned, this book does tell us that the Ali Bateen invented Islam and found a sleeper who they claim is the historical Islamic prophet Muhammad, and made him think it was his idea. This is a very questionable decision to put into a book. And then not only that, they actually put some oil on the fire by saying that this sleeper added his own barbaric ideas into Islam, and now they're a part of Islam. And it's like, wow, that not only did you, like, put your foot in it, but then you fell over face first. This is not...
That guy's also dumb.
Basically, it's like... Of course, my thinking is, if I'm going to have Muslim players at my table, which I think would be awesome, I'm going to edit that out because I don't think that's a good idea. That could be offensive to them. I mean, maybe not, but this chapter is directly connecting the entire Ali Bateen faction of mages to hundreds of years of conflict in the Middle East. And is this really something we want to do? I mean, and the nice thing is, if you edit that out, the book does not suffer at all. The rest of the material in the book is just fine. That is an adjustment I have no trouble making. In my own chronicles, I have another faction of mages that I invented, that I have much more connected with Islam, especially the Sunni faction of Islam. And I have them based in Mecca, and I have them have more influence there. And so in my own chronicles, I have the Ali Bateen. They feel a sense of, I don't know, what is it, a friendship or something with the Shiite Muslims, but I don't have them say that they invented that or anything like that. And I really like the information they give on the Zawiya locations for Ali Bateen. A Zawiya could be a chantry, but it also just could be like a safe house of theirs that is not actually a chantry, but it is a location where Bateeni mages, you know, live and work. And it says that their connection to sacred geometry actually shows up in these Zawiya locations. It says they always have a dome, they always have repeating motifs in the architecture that are symbolic of Mount Kaf. And I just really enjoyed that. As a storyteller, it helps me get a handle on those scenes where the players visit Bateeni mages, and I've got a conversation piece, I've got a theme to run with, and I just really appreciated that. The groups within the Ali Bateen are called khanates, and I guess you could call them schools. First off, we have the University of Light. Their headquarters is in Jerusalem, Israel. These insular Batini specialize in spirit magic and Kabbalistic studies. Most difficult Khanate where an initiate can study. The majority of their students are female. They have an enormous underground library that has no doors, so good luck sneaking in there. Next up, we have the Silk Cartel. Their headquarters is in Samarkand, Uzbekistan. This is the smallest Khanate. It specializes in alchemy and conjuring. They value sacred geometry and focus on mazes, labyrinths, and similar puzzles. Other Khanates wonder if they are drifting too close to technocratic thinking. Few students are recruited, and they're wondering how long they can continue. Next up, we have the Paradise Garden. Their headquarters is in Isfahan, Iran. The most intense study experience is found here, as Qutubs are trained to be judges and telepathic communications operators for the Ali Batin. This Khanate supplied advisors to sultans long ago. This gave them influence over Middle Eastern nations in past years. Students are now trained in mental techniques as well as survival and stealth. This Khanate gives the best training in the mind sphere. Next, we have the Ikhwan At Tawid. Their equivalent name in English is the Brotherhood of the Unified Soul, and their headquarters is Mecca, Saudi Arabia. These are ascetics and assassins who remove those who oppose unity directly. The leading Murshid spends some time in Mecca, but the other members are not in Mecca. They train in the desert of Saudi Arabian Peninsula. Currently a male-only group that trains constantly in combat, stealth, assassination, and extracting information from their targets. It does mention in the text that membership is not restricted to only men, but at this time, only the men are the ones who want to live in very severe conditions out in the middle of nowhere and do constant military drills and learn how to kill people with their bare hands. The final Khanate is the Darwushim. Their headquarters is in Baghdad, Iraq. These are extreme ascetics. They live simple lives and hold to the oldest practices of fasting, ecstatic dances, and self-inflicted ordeals. They specialize in correspondence and prime. They strive for a fusion of ecstasy and control to better attune themselves with primal energy flows in the world. And so those are the five Khanates of the Ali Batin, the five factions within that group.
The mention that they had about the University of Light, where they're like, yeah, there's a giant vault with no doors. And you're like, your master's a correspondence. This makes sense.
Yeah.
The next section we get are paradigm and focus. And most of the foci that they give are pretty straightforward or dependent on the culture tied to one of the Khanates. Like, for instance, they talk about how for matter, the traditional trappings of alchemy are common, kilns, alembics, rare essences, and that they have ascetic practices for mind, such as coming up with patterns, and that mathematics and geometry are very important to them, and that ascetic trances and extreme fitness and meditation are important for life, once again with strange foci. The one that didn't make sense to me was correspondence, where they're like, Mobius strips. Like, okay, mirrors, angles. I need a little bit more to go on. They're like paper thingies. This is one of those things where M20 has spoiled me in, like, you have the rock solid connection, hopefully, between paradigm, practice, instrument to create focus. And then I look at some of these previous books and they're not quite there, where they're like, I'm going to use a map to fold space by folding the map. I'm like, doesn't that depend on a predicating worldview that there is a connection between the map and the space? And they're like, maps. And you're like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing here. There's also mention of being like, oh, we're the Ali Batin. We love labyrinths. And then you know who else loves them? The Nafandi. And one of the Nafandi is like, yeah, these bitches are addicted to labyrinths. You just put them on one, they just kind of walk it. It's amazing. It's like a duck in water. But one of the asides they do is, yeah, a bunch of Ali Batin descend into the labyrinth, but also some people walk it and then just disappear. And other people walk it, lie into the heart of Balfius, and they're like, yeah, okay, what now? And they're like, don't you feel a tug on your soul drawing you towards oblivion? And you're like, no, I'm not an idiot. One of the perks they list is the fact that you can get a high-ass arcane rating. They provide a rote that is a way in which one can raise one's arcane rating, that after you get to the sixth dot, you lose the ability to turn it off, And at the seventh level, instead of the arcane rating being a dice pool that rolls against someone else's attempt to detect it, now flat out removes successes. At 10 dots, if you were to write your name in stone, it would quickly erode away in minutes. The mage suffers brief moments of amnesia as she forgets her own existence, and for a moment or two, several times a week, she may physically fade from the Tellurian and become insubstantial. They don't give a good enough explanation to me of why people do that. I could see the Alibatian having a small group of people that either for mystical purposes or for practical purposes have incredibly high arcane ratings. If your mere presence causes entire detection systems to simply fail, having someone with an arcane rating of 8 or 9 is an amazing way to have an assassin, especially when combined with correspondence. So it's kind of funny that if you have a high enough arcane rating, you no longer have to be subtle. Like, I just picture this Batin getting into a syndicate compound to execute someone, and like the one picture they have of this person like slitting this Pentex executive's throat, he's wearing like flip-flops and bright pink shorts and has a shirt that says "I'm with stupid" on it, and they're making like a peace sign at the camera, and they're like, "Who did this? I can't tell." And like, no matter what happens, everyone's like, or something like that.
Yeah, the first edition take on the Alibatin was they get a sphere specialization in both correspondence and mind, but the counterbalance for that, the disadvantage that they got, was they cannot learn any in entropy. And not only that, but they cannot do direct counter magic of entropy because they don't know any entropy. Now, here we are in Revised, and they're saying that Batini player characters specialize in one sphere, and most Batini mages cannot learn any entropy. And it basically says, if this is a player character Batini mage, then give them plus one arcane. If they have zero, they go to one. If they have five, they actually go to six. And for me, it was interesting because, you know, arcane is one of those core concepts of mage, and I'm not going to go too far on this, but I just wanted to say that the only other place that we discuss arcane ratings higher than five is in Isle of the Mighty, which was actually looks like more of a changeling book, but it was a crossover changeling and mage book, and there's a section on Scotland, and there's one NPC there, and he has that, and so we sort of briefly discuss it. There's more detailed here, but in the first edition of Mage, I kind of got this impression that arcane was when a mage was somehow mystically pulled farther away from the regular world of sleepers and most people who live on Earth, and they were more closely thrust directly into the mystical world where you have Bygones and Umbrood and mages and other awakened beings. And so this book seems to take a different approach to the nature of arcane, and that is not so much that you're taken out of the sleeper world and put more firmly into the mystic world, it's that you are completely taken out of the whole world. I'm not going to say that one is better than the other, I just thought it was interesting that this is actually a different approach to it.
The next thing we get are rotes. Some of them were quite interesting. One was the idea of the Hajjaj, which is a correspondence, life, mind, and optionally time effect, which allows you to steal health levels from other people, also makes you unembraceable by vampires if you target that person. So as they try and suck out your health, you immediately gain it back from them. And it includes this amazing line of, should the vampire notice, he may beat the mage to death, but he won't get any blood. I was a little bit concerned with the rote downward spiral, where with mind three, you can cause someone to commit suicide. And I'm uncomfortable with that for several reasons. Installment 17 of Terry's ongoing series, I am fundamentally uncomfortable with mind sphere. It has the rote dowsing, which is a correspondence to forces to effect that allows a Batin mage who needs to find something to cause it to kind of manifest. I do like the idea of using this as a coincidental rote to have access to a weapons cache or food or shelter or something like that, where the character rolls, they get a number of successes, and they more or less either cause something to manifest or teleport something to where they need it. We get the rote of the Gaiba, which is this correspondence for mind 2, prime 4 or 5, spirit 3 rote, which allows someone to increase their arcane temporarily or permanently. I like the idea of a rote that allows you to increase a background. I guess maybe I feel differently about arcane because when you get to the super high levels, it is kind of self-balancing because you're like, yeah, you're the greatest technological assassin, but your friends forget who you are after an hour. There is the ultimate incarnation of the Doctrine of Unity where it's like, ah, we are all the same person. So if I drink poison, so does everyone else in this room. And I'm like, okay, that's one way to interpret things. Then we get places. One is we get Jebel Kaf or Mount Kaf. I would have liked a lot more information on this because I don't know of another place where it gets answered. And it seems super core to the cosmology and mythology, for lack of a better term, of the Batin mages, that it's something that Batin mages would talk about, and they would mourn its loss and try and recreate. The other thing we get is information on the Web of Faith. It allowed for great workings of magic to capture djinn and marauders. Oil wasn't the literal source of quintessence, but the stores of quintessence represented by the faith of the area invested the oil as TAS once the paradigm in the area changed. They have a brief thing about a mono tradition game where everyone is going to disagree with everyone else on things and everyone's going to have hidden agendas. And that changed my interpretation of things. To me, the Batin were kind of like Apple computers. So Apple is notably obsessed with secrecy. But within the company, it is generally considered to be an open culture where everyone can talk internally about what they're working on, unless it's super top secret. But between the company and the rest of the world, there is utter secrecy. And that's how I interpret the Batin, where they share information freely among themselves, which is a natural side effect of using telepathy all the time. But with outsiders, they don't share information. But here they kind of indicated that even within the organization, there is great secrecy, which I could partially understand, but is probably not how I would interpret it. We get character sheets and character templates. We get a sexy researcher. We get dancer who throws things on fire. And we get angry man with scepter, but amazing hair. And then we also get a section on legends, which are kind of plot hooks if you want them to be, which are just legends, fables, and ideas that are out there in the world that could be used in a Batin chronicle. They talk about possible oracles that could be out there, and then we wind down on the chapter.
This portrayal of the Batini mages is not as secretive as the original in Book of Shadows and first edition of Mage. It said that the Khanates are not aware of each other or told that each other Khanate is like a totally different group of mages. And so a Batini mage isn't like fully cognizant of the fact that they are a Batini mage until they become an adept and they get welcomed into the secret society, basically. And this book states that the Khanates are aware of each other, and students know that they are Batini in training, and it is after they complete their training and they leave the Khanate to go be active in the world that they become part of these cells that are not aware of each other. And so the secrecy is still there in this portrayal, but it's not quite as secret as the first edition portrayal. And of course, a storyteller is free to work with whichever version of that they would like. I thought it was fun that they had a sidebar talking about magical tomes that Batini mages study. And it really seemed to support the first edition notion of mage-only magical training books. That is, books written by mages for mages that sleepers just totally could not understand if they even got their hands on it. Gave specific titles for books and what kind of mage knowledge or spheres you're going to learn if you read this book. And it talks about how the books specifically treat with mage concepts like avatars and arcane, etc. So I thought that was a lot of fun. I got a really nice idea of what the Batini foci are, what the Batini magical styles are, what tools they use, what cultural elements they bring into their magic, and I really like that. But one thing I was actually kind of hoping for was just a sort of a basic bedrock explanation of their paradigm. And when I talk about paradigm, I mean basically like, how is it they think that magic can be in the world, and how is it that humans can like get their hands into magic and do some themselves? And I felt like that kernel wasn't really there. And so I'm not going to say it's a big complaint, but it just would have been nice to see that. I mean, just a little short paragraph to give me a clue. And the last one is the rote for occultation, which allows a Batini mage to raise their arcane very high for a period of time, even up to a year, and then it ends and they come back to normal. And it sort of hints that if they do that a lot, then they become more permanently occulted. This is new to this book. In first edition, Batini mages could not go over arcane 5, just like other mages at that time. And the idea was, in first edition, their high degree of secrecy came from, I mean, not to be insulting, but kind of from paranoia. They knew that they could not do entropy magic. They knew that other mages could. They had no counter magic against it, and they were fearful. They were very worried. And so they pursued a very high degree of standard normal kind of secrecy, as in, you know, spend some time by yourself and don't share information even with those you know. It gave the mention in the first edition Book of Shadows that the Alibatin as a group are so secretive that they actually have a hard time functioning in some situations. It actually limits their ability to do certain things. They are so concerned about secrecy, but they don't have like specific high arcane to help them do that. This book changed it and said, no, they're a little more open, they're a little more, you know, well-functioning, but they can push their arcane over 5.
I'm also annoyed that they present imaginary numbers as something that is somehow weird. I think a lot of things about imaginary numbers would be changed if we just didn't call them imaginary numbers. Chapter 2 of this 3-chapter book is the Taftani, and the opening story is about a Hitmark cyborg in a plane that is trying to take out a guy on a flying carpet and fails a lot. Needless to say, the Taftani carpet flying mage seems to make it out largely okay. And I just got the sense that the person writing this had fun doing it. Because it's one of those things where, like, Adam and I have talked before about how the Hermetics are portrayed as arrogant. And one of the ways of dealing with that is to portray them as not arrogant. Another way of doing that is like, no, what if they were more incredibly arrogant mages? And we got the Wulong and the Taftani. No one has the monopoly on acting like an asshat. We go into the glossary section, quickly go into history. This history may get the record for the largest period where they just don't talk about it. It starts about 5,000 years ago, where they say at the dawn of language, they said that people who wrote poems and who carefully chose their words could change the world. And the idea was, if you created a poem that was filled with asha, or truth, what is more directly translated as fire, you could change the world around you by invoking this. In my head, I have always associated the Taftani with Zoroastrianism, but they never actually mention it here. It traces the history of ancient Persia. They're like, yeah, Sargon the Great. I'm like, that's good. Artaxerxes. I'm like, I recognize these names from the Bible. We also find out the vital point in history that spirits were real assholes back then, until Solomon the Wise came along, or Suleiman. Suleiman figured out that spirits were bound by rules that even spirits did not know, and that over time, he slowly learned these rules and used those to gain mastery over the Jinn and gain the upper hand in interactions. And boy howdy, do the Jinn not like him. Any paragraph where he is mentioned, 2/3 of that paragraph, if it's from a Jinn point of view, is just insulting him. And then it just kind of jumps forward to 2001. They're like, there was a vampire in Petra and we took it back and we're on the rise again. Everyone watch out. I'm like, everything in between that they list is just kind of Middle Eastern history.
Yeah, it was a mention to one of the A World of Darkness supplements that they put out in the past.
They have a geopolitics section, which is like, we're everywhere where civilization isn't. And they go through the list of countries where it's like, yeah, we're big in Afghanistan. We're big in the empty quarter of Saudi Arabia. We're the dominant paradigm there. Also the American Southwest, and we will never mention that again. That the group kind of had a decline because one of the cornerstones of their belief is that life is created literally out of conflict, that matter coalesces in areas of the universe where there is conflict present between Asha and Dirush, between light and darkness, that places of exceptional conflict cause life to manifest, and that the best way of dealing with a slight disagreement with someone else is to get in a magic duel and either blow up in a cloud of paradox or cause the other person to be burnt to cinders. And to think there's not a lot of them. They believe strongly in freedom. They refuse to join the traditions, and they dislike situations where you have few options. Their education is often very wide-ranging, and they're a big fan of polytheism because they're like, why worship just one god? So as I said, the core of their belief is that the universe is a struggle between Asha and Druj, and these are conflict-prone mages who love conflict. They could give the House Titulus a run for their money in terms of their enjoyment of direct personal conflict. They also say that comfort and hospitality are important, that asceticism is a sign of somebody not being challenged. Once again, shots fired on the Batin. It wasn't one of those things that they so much want to be nice to other people as they like having really nice things, and in a desert you have to share things. It's kind of just like a byproduct of it. And that they don't have a notion of ascension, which I really liked, because they're like, why would I go somewhere else? Magic should be here. Now, around me. Also, figs. So it was this kind of idea that it's like, yes, let's remake the world, but not in the world peace sense, but in the I'm going to create a giant floating palace for myself where everyone whizzes around on carpets and recognizes how awesome I am and also has unlimited access to figs. That's one way of viewing ascension. I can get behind that.
I thought it was just interesting that the Ali Batin, who were founding members of the Council of Nine Mystic Traditions, pursue ascension. They talk about it, and that's a goal for them. And then in Book of Crafts in second edition, it said craft mages, for the most part, don't worry about ascension. It's not a thing for them. And here we have the Tatani, who are disparates or a craft, and they don't pursue ascension. It's like, well, yeah, okay, yeah. That fits.
They believe strongly that the idea of openly doing vulgar magic will kind of introduce wonder and or terror back into the lives of the communities that surround them. One of the best ways in their mind of switching the paradigm is to openly do vulgar magic, is to summon the djinn, is to fly around on the carpet. And they often end their lives with a massive burst of vulgar magic. They simply want the world to return to a more magical time, and that they believe that the traditions, by eschewing vulgar magic, are doing the work of the technocracy for them. And they say that in no uncertain terms. This is the big book of shots fired. Just the Teftown, you're like, who could we insult now? They go through their view of the traditions, kind of call all the other traditions wusses. Like the opening line from the Celestial Chorus is, the monotheists, oh please, the very notion that there is but a single god is so ludicrous that it strains credibility. It was stupid when the Hebrew said it was stupid when the Christian said it, and it was stupid when the Muslim said it. I'm like, okay, how about that? And to think you don't get along with people.
Next conflict, you guys?
Yeah. They talk about having reverence for the marauders, where they're like, these people are taking it to the 10th degree and we tip our hats to them. And you're like, oh, okay. They talk about how hunters from Hunter the Reckoning are soldiers of falsehood. They have no organization. They only tend to get together during apprenticeship and once every 6 months. They tend to get in conflict with one another. That often results in explosions. Every 6 months, they celebrate something called a haram, which is where they get together and just talk about how great their apprentices are and how many djinns they've captured and eat figs together. The apprenticeship process starts between 11 and 16. They either find people who are very capable or people who really weird stuff happens around it. They now take on runaways because they figure anyone who's able to flee across the desert and find them in their mountain hideout is probably good enough. And they talk about how your service to the Taftani cause ends in only one of two cases: death or archmastery. They make no further mention to Taftani archmasters. And I don't know about you, but the notion of an archmaster of forces who believes that vulgar magic is okay, I'm already crapping my pants a little bit. They talk about how pederasty is common. And even within that, they're like, you and your Western sensibilities. I'm like, you're leaning into this. Okay. They also mention that instructors are very protective of their apprentices. And they talk about they sometimes have nightmares about not properly enlightening their students. And I just like the idea that among the Taftani, they don't have the dream where they're like, oh, I was in front of my classroom and I was in my underwear. They're like, I forgot to teach my apprentice the seventh pillar of Darwisham. No, like, or something like that. And they just like wake up in a sweat and they have to look at a calendar to figure out that they already did that lesson or something like that. There is no internal police. They just fight people. Duels are very common. They mention that they have no sense of internal police, but they have a strong sense of justice in that if you do a small disrespect to a Taftani, it is not unreasonable that you have made an enemy for life. The part that I kind of liked was when they got into the magic and how it is embodied. The two big spheres that they really talked about here are going to be forces, because that is a direct manifestation of conflict and is also a very easy way to end conflict, as well as spirit for control of djinn. Poetry is very common, that the ability to recite long written works from memory are a way of focusing yourself and reaching ecstasy. And the ability to recite poetry well is almost a mandatory pre-requirement for being a member of the group. Before we get to the paradigm and focus section, they talk about their factions. Adam, who are the factions within the Taftani?
The Taftani factions are, as you would expect, very few and very light. They don't have committees that get together and vote on policy. It's just sort of a general recognition of you follow this tradition with a lowercase t. First off, we have the Zaotar, the direct, blunt, and brash mages that give Taftani their reputation. Often specializing in forces effects, these mages believe there is honesty in obvious magic. Their vulgar effects are not meant to be flashy, but forthright and courageous. They also use items they craft themselves in their magic, such as pots, bottles, weapons, etc. Next up, we have the Kahin, the poets and diviners of the Taftani. The Kahin use verse, entropy, and mind effects to achieve more subtle magic. They are usually milder and more soft-spoken. And that covers it for the factions of the Taftani.
They talk about duels between the Xehanort, and it's like, it's whoever can knock off the first fireball, and then between the Kahin, it's whoever can get off the first great hex, and they talk about hexes and counter hexes, and I had never heard the word counter hex before, and I'm like, yeah, I guess that has to be a thing. And then they talk about what happens between a fight between the Xehanort and the Kahin, where the Xehanort is going through this long extended ritual to summon a fire elemental to blow up the other guy, and then the Kahin gets off a curse and every bone in the other person's body just shatters.
I see two very different ways that a person reading this chapter could get an impression of the Tahtani. And one is the crude, boorish, ignorant person who's always starting fights and says, yeah, I don't care, deal with it, and doesn't make a lot of friends. But then the other way you can see these people is very courageous, very independent group of people who really are going to pursue their own thing. And if they have to make sacrifices for it, they are willing to do that. Basically, when it comes to the basic idea of paradigm and consensus in Mage the Ascension, you could see the Tahtani as the people who see a bulldozer coming right for them. And so they jump right into the shovel plow at the front of the bulldozer and start punching on it with their fists saying, I'm going to beat this. And of course, yeah, that's incredibly ignorant. You're done at that point. But the other way you could see this is the Tahtani are saying to the other mages, look, the technocracy control the consensus now. They're running the show. You're playing their game. You're playing by their rules. Do you think you're going to win that? Because I don't think you're going to win that. And so, yeah, it's interesting how there's really two very different approaches a storyteller could choose to take when working this group into their game. I see the Tahtani as like the ultimate underdogs of Mage. It's like the world changed without them. They said, nope, not going to change. Oh, I've got to go out and live in the wilderness or die? Yeah, I'll just do that. I am not going to bend the knee no matter what's going on in the rest of the world. I've got my own way of doing things. And yeah, there's something to say against stubbornness, but then there's also something to say in the favor of independence. I think putting them out in these very remote places and having them do their old style magic as they did hundreds of years ago really brings up discussions of paradigm and consensus in your mage games. I think they're like lightning rods for discussions on consensual reality. And a storyteller could conceivably take two approaches to this. A storyteller could take an NPC Tahtani, put it in front of the players, and have them get totally destroyed by paradox and say, ha, there you go, players. Why don't you watch your step? That is one approach you could take. The other is you could show a Tahtani NPC in, you know, wilderness area, and they're doing their magic, and they get away with it. It works. And the players are like, what? Oh, you mean the consensus is different out in wild places? It's like I've kind of entered a different world, but I'm still on the earth that I know. Wow, this is something I didn't think about. And so you can introduce this concept to your game if you would like to do that. I thought their views on other factions was really great. Not only entertaining to read, but it makes sense how they could see other groups like this. In my games, I have the Tahtani a little bit more friendly towards each other because I want to make it believable that they have in fact survived as a viable group into this late date. And so I kind of tone down the fatal duels that they have with each other. I have sort of an informal truce that they're always nervous about trying to keep but sometimes break. And so that is my way of sort of justifying how they have survived this long. But of course other storytellers are going to work with them as they choose. And as Terry mentioned, the pederasty issue, I was actually starting to read this chapter, and I was like, hey, this is a different group. This is an interesting group. Not necessarily like I want to be one and see them succeed in the world, but I mean, they're so interesting. And then I hit, they're all pederasts. They take 11-year-old boys and do awful things with them. And it's like, okay, look, my point of view, I've raised three sons myself, and I'm still in the process of doing so. And when I read about pederasty, I'm like, well, red flag, I don't like this topic. Not down with this. But then I started to think, all of the Tahtani are living out in very rural, remote places in the Middle East. And so I know from our own real world that in rural Pakistan and large portions of Afghanistan and in other nearby nations, pederasty actually is an issue. There are problems with that. There are people both in those cultures and from foreign cultures who have noticed this and are trying to correct this issue, which is really a very terrible thing. But to say here, all Toftani mages are get into pederasty. For me, it's like reading about Ireland before the year 1900 and saying, yeah, all the Irishmen are drunks. It's like, no, that's a terrible thing to say, and it's not true, and I'm not going to make that statement. No one should be making that statement. And so I saw that the same way. It's like, all the Toftani are pederasts. I'm like, no, I don't think so. I really don't have any trouble editing that out and saying this is an issue in this group, but not all of them have this problem.
Yeah, it was one of those things where it kind of felt like the author was going for shock value more than anything else, where it's like, oh, your Western sensibilities on vulgar magic, your Western sensibilities on sexual mores, deal with it. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I'm with Terry on that.
Paradigms and focus. And we talked about how fire is truth and represents Asha and burns away Druge. And the nice thing about fire being truth is you can physically manifest fire as opposed to having to physically manifest math. Clarity is very important to them, that if a mage succumbs to addiction, mental illness, or spiritual possession, they are obliged to give away all of their things and blow themselves up. They believe that their magic is part of a three-part process of approaching truth. One must have clear thought to burn away uncertainty. One must have direct action, as the fire of truth does not compromise, and one must use magic. The goal of magic is to capture truth, and often their foci are embodiments of that. Matter effects, when you weave a tapestry or create a glass bottle or make a piece of pottery, you are capturing truth in solid form, and the effect is contained within it. This strikes me as a group that is going to make a lot of charms. This is a group that, to me, is going to prepare a lot of ritual vessels ahead of time. They view resonance as a badge of honor, where they're like, I did magic, and magic is sticking around to me. Everything within 15 feet of me automatically lights on fire. Aren't I great? And the first rote they give you is the devouring gullet of flame, that you throw a brass and bronze ring at someone and it turns into a tunnel of fire. And using forces, instead of you bringing the fire to the bad guy, you bring the bad guy to the fire. Where it uses forces to just like shove them through this giant tunnel of flame, which I don't know about you, is vastly more terrifying to me. Like the idea of a fireball coming towards me, I'm like, oh no. But like, I'm like, there's a blazing inferno over there. And then against my will, my feet start sliding against the floor. Again, that's a life two effect, because I'll be crapping my pants. The rote required to bottle a djinn, and how it is completely coincidental, since djinn are not accepted by mortals as part of the natural spirit world, that reality is like, they're being jerks. They don't help actually do anything. They're not water spirits or anything. Go ahead, capture them. So like, you could capture a djinn in front of full view of everyone, and it's completely coincidental. And people are just kind of like, what happened? And reality's like, I'm going to allow this. By far, the two coolest rotes. One was the one that allows you to delay paradox. It is a prime 3, spirit 3, time 3 effect that when you succeed, if you incur paradox, each point of paradox only enters your paradox pool after days equal to the number of successes you got. So if you are about to get 10 points of paradox and you get 5 successes on this, you only get 1 point of paradox every 5 days. And it talks about how Toftani have difficulty with the self-control aspect of it, where it's like, but I want to do vulgar magic. And they're just like waiting for this giant backlash to slowly bleed off. The other one that I thought was amazing was the Shatir's Sentence, which is a Entropy 3, Life 2, Mind 2 effect, where you write a poem that is so insulting that people's stats go down, where you could basically call someone a butterface and cause their appearance to drop. One of the really neat parts of that was the character of the Black Sheik, who comes to New York, and before they can do so, they buy this building in New York City and just remove all of the wiring and so on from it to prevent the technocracy from having any hold there, and rides to America on the back of a djinn with 20 bottles of containing other spirit entities, and that when they get to this empty building, they just start uncorking them and forcing their djinn servants to bring figs and other such things to the area, and just kind of creates this sumptuous garden of delights. And I thought that was evocative and interesting, even if that represented so much paradox, it would make my head explode. And then finally, we have the legend section, where it talks about the City of Brass, which gets mentioned a couple of times in Mage. I think the first proper mention of the City of Brass with details came up came up in Book of Worlds, where it was originally a realm that was tied to Mercury that slowly fell apart. And here it makes mention that the City of Brass is still very much out there in the Umbra, that most mages have lost track of it, but that the Void Engineers have started to venture into it, which to me is a fascinating mental image. And then it discusses Aram of the Tall Columns, which is a legend, a lost city that was part of the Persian Empire that was held aloft by 40-foot columns of ruby and aquamarine. It is the only known horizon realm of the Taftani, which I assume means it's very explodey, like exceptionally explodey. And they say it smells very nice. And that brings us to the end of the chapter. What did you think of the second half of the chapter?
Well, I really liked the section on the Taftani strengths and weaknesses with different spheres. It was specific and it made sense. And as a storyteller, I really liked that. If I'm going to use them as NPCs, I really want to get material like that. I thought they had a good world view. You know, again, really nice information on their foci and their style, etc. But again, just the kernel, the basic paradigm. It's like how can they do magic, or how does a mage get his hands into the magic that's in the world? You know, just at a basic level. Page 86 had resonance effects, you know, how different spheres and stuff are going to affect Taftani mages who are very involved with them. And I just loved them. It was like reading in the first edition core book what happens when mages become adepts or masters with certain spheres, and they like actually become very different sorts of people, almost unearthly. It was like reading that again. And so it's like, oh man, that is so much fun. I love that. The NPC character Haji Ayyub Afridi is an older Taftani mage who's powerful and very successful in the world. And he runs a giant drug empire in, I think, Afghanistan. And I was reading that, I was thinking, well, okay, it's interesting, and it brings in a couple of different moral conflicts that a storyteller could use in their game. But honestly, I think this Taftani mage is too high profile. It's like these are high risk, organized crime sorts of operations. I think this is going to attract a lot of sleeper attention and a lot of mage faction attention. And so this seems to be so high profile. I really wonder how this Taftani mage could keep this operation going for so many years. So, and also, Terry mentioned the Black Sheikh, the Taftani mage who went from the Middle East to a big American city and set up shop. I don't know how to feel about that, because it's really interesting,
yeah,
and it's really fun. But at the same time, it's like, I think you're pushing things too far. I don't think in the world of mage that this would be very successful for more than a week. It's such a fun idea, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know if I can really run with this. I think we're pushing things. I'm ready to look at chapter 3 on the djinn.
Djinn! This section kind of brings together what has been mentioned in a few others. And just like the Order of Hermes book, Blood Treachery, introduced a bunch of umbral courts and updated hermetic magic, this talks about the djinn, that they occupy a space between spirits and bygones. They are too solid to be concepts, but they are not so solid as to trigger reality's immune system in the form of unbelief. They were listed as Allah's first attempt at creating free will, and that there were 100,000 of them, that as an afterthought, with the remainder of their greatness, with the dust and detritus left over after they are made, Allah then created humans. Humans bred much faster, and soon the djinn were outnumbered. Early shifters came to them, the precursors to the Garu, but the djinn refused to trade power for service. They refer to the 10,000 djinn plague as the War of Enslavement. This occurred roughly 3,000 years ago, and that humans had finally figured out the rules by which they operate. Again, they're not a big fan of Solomon slash Suleiman, that some djinn promised themselves to early fallen Batin, Iblis, a recurring character, the Iblisi, those who had kind of fallen to the Nafandi, to form an alliance to try and smite the mortals. And those who became bound to the Devil Kings became known as the Ifrit. They had descended into Malphius. They had become kind of tainted. Once the war was over and it was clear they could not win, some came back. Others were either bound to service or had lost too much of themselves and became the modern Ifrit. It mentions that djinn that spend too much time in the world become Jean and lose magic. And this was a absolutely fascinating idea that I wish they had given more information on, like a few merits or how to have a Jean NPC or what that would look like. In M20, we get the idea of the Nephilim background, or the Lahame, I think, is the other option. After the 10,000 Jin plague ended, the Jin largely pulled back into what they refer to as the invisible world, essentially what I assume is the Umbra, and they've spent all their time there. But there are very young Jin, under 3,000 years old, Jin being very long-lived, who are very curious about what they consider to be their birthright, their ability to be in both worlds, and that there are young Jin that are exploring the world, and that's causing all sorts of excitement, that if your characters are going to encounter one, it's likely to be one of these younger adolescent Jin. At one point, they built the City of Brass on a great node after viziers had sworn to live in the city that they forced the Jin to make. So the Jin, being clever sons of guns, made it entirely out of brass in the middle of a desert to make it incredibly hot. The vizier spent almost all of their magic just to be able to survive, to keep their end of the promise. And this was kind of one of the first great examples of the Jin being kind of tricky. Organizationally, they build vast cities where every tree is actually a wood spirit of some sort, and every intersection has a grand fountain in it. They are led by, each city is led by a caliph, which is generally 6 to 10 millennia old. Caliphs are governed by the emirs, which are 9 to 15 years old. And the sultanate is this family, or at least collection, of the most powerful emirs, and they are near godlike in terms of potency. To me, they are probably below Inkarna, but probably either weak Inkarna or strong Gafflings. The sultanate rules Jin society. The next section goes into the varieties of Jin. Adam, what kind of Jin we got running around?
Well, we've got four categories here of the Jin. When I first started reading this chapter, it was difficult for me because I'm used to like an I on the end being the plural in one or two languages. And in this case, Jin is plural and genie is singular. So that threw me. But first off, we have the Shayateen, avowed enemies of humans. These Jin defend Jin citadels in the invisible world and visit Earth to exact vengeance on humans. They assume all mages want to entrap them. Meaningful cooperation or even communication with these zealots may be impossible. The Ifrit, Jin who continue to side with the Devil Kings and Malphius. They can still be a part of Jin society, but are not supposed to encourage support among the Jin for Malphius. Most live in Malphius, a twisted and evil realm covered in other mage books. Most Ifrit are associated with fire or a sort of mystical evil fire, Baal fire. We have the Amar, Jin who want to live in the human world and pass for humans. They prefer to live outside of the Middle East. They can still use their Jin powers, but prefer not to. They have strained relations with most Jin who live in the invisible world, or the Umbra. If you remember the 1965 TV show I Dream of Genie and want to bring that into Mage, the Amar are the Jin for you. Please note that Mage the Podcast does not condone mixing 60s sitcoms with the world of darkness. Last, we have the, I believe it's pronounced the Rajim, Jin who are banished from Jin society and live on Earth and pass for humans. Unlike the Amar, the Rajim look down on humans and use their powers frequently. They are sociopaths who choose human victims to terrorize in very awful ways. And that is basically our four group of Jin.
The Jin are listed as settling wars, generally by proxy, that you get someone to fight for your behalf. And they kind of mention that some wars in the Middle East may have been spillovers from this, at which point I'm like, I would include that as in-world legend, like it is said that, but I would probably never make something like that canon. They are on good terms with the Elemental Court of Air and Fire, that their hatred of Solomon runs deep. And they include an aside that I thought was fascinating, where they say, at the time of Solomon's death, it was rumored that he was working on a similar code for demons. And I don't know about you, but those words say plot twist all over him. The idea behind the Code of Solomon is that it forces, that not that it was a code imposed by Solomon, but it was a set of discoveries Solomon made on how Jin need to interact when in the material world. By adhering to it, it makes the process of binding a Jin much more straightforward. They want emotion and sacrifice from their mortal binders otherwise, so that tends to be what they want in arrangements. That the Jin as a storytelling element are useful because they have motivations just like humans, but they are often strange. But they also talk about how, like, since Jin are immortal in the sense that they have no natural lifespan, that really changes how they view things, where they're like, I hate this guy, but I don't want to fight him directly. I would much rather promise myself to 2 years of indentured labor to 10 people and have them go knock off the mage that I'm kind of annoyed at rather than me having to do it myself. That they consider periods of service of 60 years, not unreasonable because of how short-lived mortals are. Again, when you are functionally immortal, spending a couple of decades being someone's assistant is pretty straightforward. They hate the Toftani specifically because they tend to pass down genie from master to apprentice, and that really bothers them. So it's interesting that they have largely human motivations, except for a few other things. And they talk about how the Jin consider mortals to be kind of stupid. So they will do something that, like, you will summon one and they will be like, oh, you summoned a genie, but you want to argue with me. I can't believe you're wearing shoes. Don't you know that shoes are considered taboo in our society or something like that? And the mage will take off their shoes quickly and apologize. And they'll be like, dummy, we don't care about shoes. It gives recommendations on how to bargain with them and the difficulties of it and the importance of the code. And then we get a few sample Jin characters, which are fine. We also get a large section of charms, the abilities that Jin have. These are pretty similar to the list that we've got in other places. And that kind of winds it down.
For the Jin chapter, I really enjoyed it. I just like having a different group of spirits. It's like, in a sense, they're halfway between Bygone and Umbrood. And I just really liked having something like that to play with in the setting, Mage of the Ascension. Jin are not complicated to use in terms of game mechanics. You basically take stats for a regular human being and then give them gifts, and you have a djinn that is in the physical world, manifested. Or if you want to use a djinn as more of a, they haven't taken on a human body, then you just basically run them like you would run a middle Umbra spirit or a high Umbra Umbrood. And so very simple, but there's a lot of interesting possibilities there, and so that makes me want to start working with them. I like their history section, because their history section was like almost 100% shadow history. It's like, this is stuff that sleepers don't even know and aren't going to have any reference to. I've actually had two kind of odd conversations where I was talking with mage fans, and they might not have been really long-term mage fans, but they were saying, oh, City of Brass, didn't they pull that out of Dungeons & Dragons? D&D has been doing that since the 70s. Like, well, yes, that is true. However, it's also true, as Terry mentioned, that the City of Brass comes from 1,000 Nights and a Night, which is Persian legends and stories that are really quite old, and so D&D was not the one to start that. But on that note, if I was going to actually use the City of Brass in my mage games, regardless of what edition I was running with, I'll bet I would reach for the City of Brass game book from Frog God Games, a small role-playing game company. They make this book for fantasy role-playing games, but it is more than 400 pages on just the City of Brass, and it's run by Jin. And they have maps. They have really cool color illustrations that are very evocative and show like a big part of the city at once. They have information about levels of the city and neighborhoods and how they're different from each other. It's like,
oh, interesting. That got updated for 5e and is available on DriveThruRPG. I will include a link in our show notes. Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, and it's also, at the time that we're recording this, they're having a 75% off on Frog God Games PDF, so I just grabbed one of those, and it was a good deal. But I really like the idea mentioned in this chapter that there are a lot of entrapped djinns in bottles that are basically floating around. They're in the sand in the Middle East. They're underground. They might even be in back alleys and cities outside of the Middle East. It's like there's a lot of djinn bottles to find. A lot of these genies were entrapped, and they've been in that bottle for an awfully long time, and any sort of mage could discover them. I think that's a fun thing to bring into mage games, even if you're not working with the Middle East or the Toftani or Ali Bateen. I loved the djinn point of view on the Dream Speaker tradition from the Council of Nine. In my mind, the Dream Speakers are sometimes treated as almost as sacred cows in Mage. It's like, these are the guys who are so with it and so smart and so, noble of character that they've always got it right. And here we have the djinn looking at the Dream Speakers saying, oh, those idiots, they treat us with respect and deference, and we walk all over them. What a bunch of chumps. I thought, wow, that's not something I read in every Mage book. So that was pretty fun. Here's a different point of view.
Yeah.
And what was interesting for me was considering how really evil a lot of djinn are, reading through this chapter, you can kind of get the impression that, oh, the djinn, they're magical and they have some grievances from long ago, but they're not all that bad. It's like, no, really, there are two large factions of djinn that are really very evil, and not just in the sense that they do terrible things to people, but they do terrible things to like the universe as a whole. Like when you team up with Malpheus and become a sociopath and start stalking anybody you can get your hands on, I mean, this is this is high-level evil. And so I think it's kind of good to keep that in mind. There are some parts of this chapter where it kind of gets into this idea of the djinn are a persecuted group of spirits that humans have been awful to for a long time. It's like, well, okay, there is that, but we should also keep in mind that a lot of these djinn are very, very evil. And even the ones who are not allied with Malphius, this is a group of spirits that is very old. They are very established in their own ways. They look down severely on humans. They see the whole human race as basically cattle, and they are terribly dishonest and proud of that fact. And so when you have Taftani entrapping Genie, this is not a moral black and white issue. This is like, there's something to be said on either side of that. And I think that moral gray area can be fun to work with in your games. But also, when you're reading through this chapter, keep in mind that they're not just an oppressed group. These are some really dishonest, tricky, and a very, very... a group of spirits with a really severe mindset that is going to put them at odds with just about everybody.
The feeling I got was it is the kid whose dad owns the big company in town and always got away with everything, suddenly getting their first parking ticket and claiming that they are oppressed. Like, it is that kind of oppression. It's talking about, this is obviously not just a metaphor for racism, he said tongue in cheek, but like, they interpret losing immense privilege as oppression. And you're like, what? You have to play by these, what do you call them? Rules? What's that? I do like the alien morality, and it's super good to just be like, wow, those people, they have a different view of things. So if that's everything about the djinn, thoughts overall in the book?
There were a few points. When talking about page layout and graphic design, there were a lot of sections on the pages where they had a gray image behind the text, and it just made that text awfully hard to read. I mean, I really would have liked it if they could have taken that Taftani logo image or some of those other ones and just brightened them up considerably. I mean, just a, sort of a hint that it's there is enough for me, because that text was darn hard to read. I did not appreciate that. Another thing is, I actually wanted to bring up a related topic, not directly, flying carpets. Flying carpets is a notion that has been sort of associated with mysticism and magic of the Middle East for a long time. I don't think it's just in the West. I think it's also in the Middle East, actually, where they tell tales of mages whizzing around on magic carpets. And as a mage storyteller myself, I've had a lot of players in the past, and I actually got to the point where I had an Ali Batin player character, and it's like, well, what about those flying carpets? And so as a storyteller, I had to actually come up with my thoughts on this. And my thoughts are basically this. My thinking was the flying carpets were basically a joke that the Ali Batin like to tell to non-Ali Batin. It's like, oh yeah, we use the flying carpets because in my mind, the actual, if you enchant a carpet and it starts, zipping around and you jump on it, one, a lot of them are not very big. And so if you want to take any people with you or any stuff with you, it can be very hard. Now, I know some rugs are larger, but also rugs are really darn hard to hold on to. It's like, I don't care what kind of glue you pasted on your backside before you sit down, when that carpet gets moving, you're going to tumble right off the back. And even if you've got amazing grip, if you've got like some objects that you put behind you, it's like, yeah, as soon as you're going 15 miles an hour, kiss them goodbye. So I just had a really hard time actually grappling with this. And so I said, okay, look, this is a joke that Middle Eastern mages tell to non-Middle Eastern mages and snicker when, Western mages actually try to enchant a carpet, jump onto it, and then fall on their head on the concrete floor in their chantry and say, you actually fell for that, you dopes.
Yeah. Kind of like the way I think we talked about it before, the virtual adepts just telling people, oh yeah, we have trinary computers.
Yeah, yeah.
They're totally different. The carpet trope is kind of interesting because, like, the reference in 1001 Nights is just that it got you there very quickly, and in some cases this is interpreted as teleportation as opposed to transit. But, like, the opening fiction in the Taftani chapter, like, the plane is going Mach 2. You're getting some sand in your teeth. So...
So I just thought it was so weird. It's like a player character said, what about the flying carpets? I want one. I was like, oh gosh, we're actually talking about this. Okay, what are my thoughts on this? But my last point on looking at the book as a whole, I just really enjoyed this book. I mean, okay, Ali Batin and the Islam issue, that's something to deal with. And the pederasty and the Taftani, that's something to deal with. But they can be dealt with. And once doing so, I really enjoy this book. I got the impression that this book was a little bit like the black sheep of the revised edition lineup, because it took a lot of kind of fun, zany, perhaps problematic elements of the high magic and the obvious magic of the classic mages, the first two editions of mages, and it sort of ported them into revised edition and said, hey, let's play with this. And yeah, on one level, I think, wow, that's fun to do that. But then on the other level, it's like, well, you know, this is revised edition. We do have some themes we're running with. And it's like, storytellers are going to have to work out to what degree they actually want to incorporate this book into their chronicles. But I just enjoyed reading it. It gave me some stuff I would love to play with as a storyteller.
The Djinn section had an interesting question on where are they? And it brought up the same issue where it's like, yeah, we've established that because the technocracy says these areas are uncivilized, the paradigm is much looser and the Toftani can get away with a lot more. But when they talk about the Djinn, they talk about if you want to keep them as these over-the-top figures, you probably need to keep them to the Middle East. But if you want to make them darker and more subtle, then the Djinn could be anywhere. And I would have loved more information about that. Like, yeah. We get references to the Ulibateen being in Michigan and to the Toftani being in the Southwest, but we don't get any information on how their magic or paradigm changed to fit the area or didn't, as is kind of implied by the Toftani. But we just don't get that information. I would have loved to have seen that.
In the early part of the chapter on the Djinn, it says that the Djinn actually need to visit the physical world for, you know, some period of time, but they also need to visit the Umbra for some period of time. They are beings connected on a fundamental level to both, and so they actually need to go to both from time to time, or they're going to have some trouble. And it wasn't very specific, but I don't think they really need to be. And I thought that was really interesting. It makes the Djinn different. But then as you continue reading the chapter, you get this impression that the Amar and the Rajim live in the physical world all the time and don't go to the Umbra. And then you have these places where the Djinn congregate in the Umbra, like the City of Brass, for example, and they stay there and they don't visit the physical world. And it's like, well, I thought you said they need to visit both. So it's like, did a lot of Djinn just say, we're going to make the sacrifice, we're going to allow ourselves to change, we're going to stay in the Umbra? But on another level, that's a fun justification for the players being in the Middle East and they run into a Djinn. It's like, yeah, it's because the Djinn need to come into the physical world. And that actually gives you a justification for taking older, more powerful Djinn, and players might meet them and have a conversation with them and be scared and sent home. But the point is, you could bring them into your game. There is a reason for Djinn to cross into the physical world. They feel like they need to be there.
This book to me is a fascinating counterpoint to Dragons of the East, where both books suddenly explain a swathe of the world that we previously didn't get any information on, but both kind of start with the premise that your characters are going to go to that area rather than that area is going to come to your characters. And I would have loved more information, as I said before, on how to include these beliefs, paradigms, and so on in other parts of the world, and maybe some help on how to do that, because that's something as a storyteller that you could kind of screw up. Like, what is that diaspora look like? But for whatever reason, this one seemed a lot more fun, maybe because it kind of banged on about tropes that we already had established in the West about fantasy and adventure, and we have that cultural touchstone of 1001 Arabian Nights. The Djinn are already established as a thing, as being a mischievous group that interacts with mortals, and you need to really keep your wits about you, and maybe those just lend themselves better to an action urban fantasy game than some of the tropes that we have from more Eastern cultural influences. It answered a lot of interesting questions to me, because when we were talking about the Cult of Ecstasy, I was curious, what does it look like for those people who use ecstatic practices but use it to go outside of themselves rather than focusing on a hedonistic interior experience? And to me, the answer in a lot of cases is you get both the Batin and the Toftani. This is a place that has that kind of ecstatic tradition. Both do it without the usage of drugs or other mind-altering substances, instead using mind-altering experiences. The internal organization was, I think, better than some of the other books, but still not great. I thought the paradigm section should have been earlier, and a few other things. They're absolutely terrible editing, though. There were cases where words at the beginning of sentences weren't capitalized. There was one section where instead of Ulibateen, it was the letters ABT, which I think was a find and replace error because maybe the author was tired of writing Ali Batin. There was a case where one of the rotes that one of the character templates had, the character didn't actually have the dots to do that. All those little tightening things that we've come to know and love with Revise. But this was a big book full of awesome ideas that I think is super fun as long as you're willing to figure out the portions that don't fit with 2020 as well. You got some story ideas, Adam?
Yeah, I was hoping to share three. Number one, Sir Makamut, I may be mispronouncing that, was the Horizon Realm headquarters of the Ali Batin before it was cut off in 1819 by a technocracy attack. A recent shallowing caused Batini in Iran to see the conference room, and several mages were sitting around a table debating as if no time passed. A shallowing will soon occur near Cairo, Egypt, attached to the Web of Faith. And Batini mages need support to rescue their comrades. They approach choristers of Egypt for help, but are very reticent to share details. The players may be nearby or called in by council representatives to help. Council of Nine leaders see a rare chance to establish ties with the Batinis, but quietly, some council reps ask the players to seize as much info on the Horizon Realm as possible. Do the players favor trust and cooperation or furthering their standing with council leadership? Also, once the players walk through the shallowing, will they be able to get out again? Number two, a Batini mage asks the players to assist a Taftani mage working unwittingly for the Unity. An elderly mage of the Taftani's Kahin faction is working with Jin on the other side of the gauntlet to translate Iram of the Tall Columns, a Lost Horizon realm, into a trio of sites where peace and trust are strengthened. He wants unity among the Taftani, but several Taftani suspect him of gathering strength to subdue them. Can the players be talked into helping this plan for peace? Outdoor survival and negotiation skills will be needed along with knowledge of spirit and prime spheres. Number three, Sydney, Australia has become one of the popular cities among Jin wishing to mingle with humans. While passing through the city, the players are approached by a Middle Easterner who identifies himself as a vizier and calls on the Solomonic Truce for aid. The mage claims the players have a duty to help contain a djinn plague that is about to erupt. As the players get involved, they discover that several Amar djinn are trying to live peacefully in the city. Several Rajim djinn have recently arrived and will soon unleash attacks against sleepers. The vizier claims the players' loyalty and offers tempting prizes if they help him, but he wants to dominate all the djinn. The Amar want help to stop the vizier and their evil brethren. Which side will the players choose? And can any djinn really be trusted? So those are three ideas of mine, and hopefully you can make something out of that. Terry, was there any quote at the end?
Oh, that Taftani section called out to me. I am cheating, and like you, I have three. One is they talk about the virtual adepts and the Sons of Aether, and their response is, some of these so-called traditions are so well established that they go back all of, what, 100 years? That's not a tradition. It's a phase. And then the one is they were talking about the sphere, what groups are drawn to which spheres for the Taftani. And in the sphere of entropy, they say the Kahin are a different story. They are drawn to the sphere of entropy like white trash to game shows. I'm like, well, then. And the final one is regarding the Taftani and their geopolitics. If ever a country is called out to the Taftani, it is America. Brash, powerful, arrogant, all of our own traits we see reflected in the national temperament of that land. One day, hopefully, we get that update. It's the Taftani are fundamentally changed in M20, if you're curious, on a less vulgar magic and pederasty approach, and more mundane explosions and maybe rock concerts. That's available in M20, and I look forward to Adam and I talking about that, I think, in the year 2024 at the current rate at which we're doing books, but a little bit sooner than that. And with that, what are we reading next, Adam?
Next up is the tradition book for the Celestial Chorus from Revised Edition, and that's about 100 pages on the group, and will probably be quite different from the one that came before. Well, with that, if you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with any questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a review for Mage the Podcast, it makes us more visible in other people's searches. You can follow us on Twitter @MageThePodcast. We're also on the web at MageThePodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes, see the order in which they were produced, and also see the complete show notes that we prepare for you. This episode is thanks to executive producers John Magnuson, Ira Grace, Richard Bat Brewster, Michael Parker, Christopher Phillips, Ilara J. Sunsern, Bryce Perry, William Martin, William Connolly, Brendan Morrill, Andrew Katz, Jenna F., Andrew Edelstein, Chris Sack, Anders, and Justin. If you would like to become an executive producer for Maze the Podcast, it would help us keep producing episodes like this one. You would also become a part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The link in the show notes will get you started. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
Go change the world. Bye.